Welcome to the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. I'm Dr. Chris Tucker from the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center and the podcast founding editor. Today, we'll be again discussing artificial intelligence and machine learning. Last episode, we spoke with Dr. Prem Ramkumar and covered a wide range of topics with clinical and research implications. In this episode, we'll dive even deeper into some of the more specific details of AI. I'm very excited to be joined for this discussion by a leading biomedical statistician, Mark Cody from Mass General Brigham. Mark's the associate editor for statistics for the Arthroscopy family of journals, and I think he's truly a gifted and talented scientist and researcher. But beyond that, he's an incredibly talented educator. I've personally had the great fortune to listen to him speak on this topic and many others. He's got a unique knack for boiling down complicated and confusing statistical concepts into fairly digestible and understandable language, and he's often got some good humorous and relatable anecdotes. I look forward to him sharing his knowledge with us today. We're going to be referencing several of his publications to include two editorial commentaries, Machine Learning in Orthopedics, Venturing into the Valley of Despair from the September 2022 issue, and Artificial Intelligence, Machine Learning, and Medicine, A Little Background Goes a Long Way Towards Understanding from the June 2021 issue. Mark, congrats on your work and welcome to our podcast.
Thanks, Chris. Happy to be here and excited to talk about this topic.
As I mentioned, I'm excited for you to share your thoughts on AI in orthopedics because I think as a researcher and a statistician, you have enough of a different perspective than us surgeons that you often shed some light on these potential blind spots we may have looking at issues from our vantage point. On my last episode, I covered many of the basics of AI and discussed some of the potential applications it can have in the clinical realm as well as in medical research. We discussed its potential and also some of its potential pitfalls and dangers. I'd like to discuss some of the other nuances of this emerging technology, starting first with the larger picture of AI. Just what is the big picture here with respect to our approach, the process, and its structure?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And I think Prem did a really nice job explaining AI as the idea of sort of emulating or automating human behavior. And so kind of like within the realm of AI, like a subset of it is machine learning, which involves, you know, the use of data and a model essentially to make predictions. As far as the larger picture, I think it's helpful to start by looking at the differences between what we know or think of as statistics and what we kind of know or what is meant by the terms machine learning. Neil Lawrence, who is currently the DeepMind Professor of Machine Learning at the University of Cambridge, and prior to that was actually the Director of Machine Learning for Amazon, had a great tweet on this difference. So to quote him, he said, "Statisticians want to turn humans into computers. Machine learners want to turn computers into humans. We meet somewhere in the middle." And what I really like about this tweet is it kind of gets after the philosophy guiding each of these approaches. So historically, statistics has really been kind of about removing our own biases and tendencies that we all have when we look at data, right? And this is kind of a part of being human. Like in a sense, we've all kind of have like these internal models in our mind about how the world works. And this is kind of really what's helped us survive. The problem is though, that when we're presented with say just a random batch of data, we'll often look at it and see a pattern. So historically what statistics tries to do is sort of remove these biases. And I kind of like an example Neil gave, which is drug approval, right? So without statistical analysis, if we looked at, say, data from a drug trial, an ineffective drug may seem effective just because we can get fooled when we look at data and sort of see patterns in the data that aren't really there. But I think there's a little bit more to statistics than sort of just hypothesis testing and thinking about drug data. And I think what's key is that when we're doing some type of statistical analysis, especially those that pop up in our papers, oftentimes what we're doing is we're trying to estimate, measure or explain some type of phenomena that we observed. So say like in the context of a paper, we may use something like logistic regression to model the propensity for infection after some type of surgery. And so the variables we put into that model and the choices we make try to help us explain what might be contributing to the risk of infection. And once we sort of identify those, we try to sort of estimate their effect. to use the example Prem used, which was smoking, you know, we might say that relative to non-smokers, maybe smokers had 2 times the odds of rotator cuff repair failure. And then we would surround that with some like level of confidence. Maybe we would say that this estimate goes from 1.1 to 4, meaning that this data is compatible with odds ratios that reflect very little risk, 1.1, all the way through a high level of risk, you know, an odds ratio of 4. But I think the key there is that we're really trying to, you know, estimate and explain kind of what's happening with the data and really trying to understand, at least maybe from a clinical perspective, what's happening with the patients you see. But conversely, with machine learning, it's really about emulating human behavior. And in some ways, it's about leveraging all those intuitions and tendencies that make us human, because we're actually pretty good at a lot of things. And it would be really great if we could, you know, automate them. So where we describe statistics with words like explain and estimate and measure, and we also talk about how to reduce bias or at very least account for our biases, when we're thinking about machine learning, it's more like we use more words like predict and recognize to sort of characterize machine learning. And then we also discuss like actually how to transfer our own tendencies and intuition to a computer so that we can automate and emulate human behavior. That's not to say that statistics can't be used to make predictions or that machine learning can't be used to estimate things. Of course they can. However, the philosophy of each is different. And I think this really plays an important role and provides some context when we read these machine learning and AI related research papers. Specifically, they have different objectives. And I think this plays a key role in how we interpret them.
I think that's a nice segue into my next set of follow-on questions, where I kind of wanted to dig into a few of the aspects of AI that we don't often talk about, the first being ethics. And so with your nice explanation there as a backdrop, I was wondering what your thoughts are on the ethics of AI as it pertains to both clinical practice, but maybe more so medical research from your perspective.
So as far as clinical practice, I think we first have to consider how we would be using or are using an AI. So in the context of clinical practice, I think it really should be a tool that assists the clinician in decision-making and not necessarily one that replaces it. And if you sort of think about like what's really the strength of some type of AI, and it's really that the methods associated with them sort of have this ability to ingest and hold really large amounts of data while they're sort of making predictions. And it's much more that we could hold or consider in our own minds. So if you'd like sort of imagine, right, if you're seeing a patient trying to hold all the research that's been published on this particular clinical problem, plus all the information that may exist in your registry or in your practice data about this clinical problem, plus all the data that's in the medical records of patients that have this, you know, clinical problem, and then try to work through all these various connections in the data to make some type of prediction for the patient in front of you is impossible, right? Like we just can't do that, but computers can. So in some ways, the computer is sort of like an upgrade to our own limited capacities. But counter to that, if you think about it, computers don't possess like some contextual understanding that we have. You can train a computer or some type of AI to recognize images. In fact, you could maybe train it to recognize images of people in an image. However, if that picture was taken, say, during the Great Depression, it would be very difficult for a computer to recognize the emotional response we may feel when looking at that photo. So in the context of AI and clinical practice, this difference between the computer and the human can really be problematic. So I think that the next thing to consider with ethics is that we need to hold AI or these AI systems accountable. Dr. Doshi Velez is another person I want to talk about. She's a professor of computer science at Harvard, and she has talked about this, I believe, in a TED Talk. But she gave this great example where they had trained a model to predict when patients in the ICU were going to die or when they were likely to die. They used volumes of medical record data. They used a bunch of physical measures, a bunch of biophysical sensors, stuff like that. And it actually arrived at a model that was highly predictive, which was great. But when they dug a bit deeper, they discovered something interesting. So it really what their question was is, wow, we have this highly predictive model, but what is the this model using when it's making this prediction? And interestingly, it wasn't using any of those physical measures or things you might think about that might correspond to predicting when someone in the ICU who's under some distress may die. And what the model was really keying on was when the word chaplain was written in the medical record. And I think her larger point was that we need to hold AIs accountable, right? Because on the one hand, they're powerful tools. They can do what we can't do, which is kind of integrate and hold all that information at once and sort of synthesize it in a way that can make a prediction, but it still lacks sort of that ability or that thing that makes us human. And her advice, and I think it's good, is to focus on like local explanations. So what I mean by holding AIs accountable is to look like we can't, I mean, there's ways to sort of look under the hood and see what's happening in an AI, but perhaps what's better is that when a specific recommendation is made and you're using this AI ethically as a tool to assist your decision-making, what was the data specifically that the model evaluated and how much weight did it put on when it made this prediction? Much like in that previous example where maybe the prediction that the patient was going to die in a few hours was probably made based off the idea that someone in the medical record wrote, like, consult clergy or find the chaplain. So in this case, in that case, when we're speaking about AI as a tool to assist and not replace decision making and the ethics surrounding it, I think the idea of local interpretation and really local explanation is important. I think you also asked about ethics in medical research. And I think we need to be mindful of the potential for AI when we're thinking about it now in a research sense and not really in how we're applying it if we have an AI that we want to use clinically. That we want to make sure that they're representative of the entire population. So I'll give you a quick example. We were recently looking at a machine learning approach for predicting overnight stay. There's a lot of models out there that do that very well. Our goal was not to develop a model for clinical use, but rather to explore kind of how well does this globally performing model that does well when it's given all the data, how well does it do when it's sort of stratified by race and ethnicity? And interestingly, you can assemble a model that's very good predictively across all your data. But when you start breaking it down by race and ethnicity, some of those racial groups and ethnic groups kind of suffer from poor accuracy. So really a seemingly well-performing model can actually perform poorly when you look at, things like race and ethnicity. And I think that raises ethical concerns. So I think it's important on both sides, one clinically to sort of recognize that it's a tool and it's a tool we need to hold accountable, and things like local explanation can help us. And on the other side, there's what we're doing from a research perspective and trying to think about as we develop these models, are they equitable across sort of everybody, that we're interested in?
Yeah, your comments relate nicely to some of the discussion I had with Dr. Ramkumar, where, we talked about the big categories of AI being generative and non-generative. And obviously there's more capacity for risk associated with the generative models, I think is kind of a general consensus, but then also supervised versus unsupervised AI. And so I think, if you had a 2x2 matrix, I feel like the intersection of generative and unsupervised has kind of the highest risk for, creating ethical dilemmas or breaches in ethics versus, the supervised non-generative AI is where you're talking about using it as a tool, having human supervision or interaction and use of it. And that seems to be where the lowest risk resides, as you kind of described in your examples there, which both make, logical sense to those of us when it's pointed out, but to a novice, you may not think of those sorts of things unless you're involved in it, like you said. So that being said, what kind of concerns do you have about this current rapid expansion of the use of AI, particularly in the realm of, AI-related publications? I mean, what are the main concerns you have about that trend right now? Is it, expanding too quickly, misuse of it, misunderstanding, misinformation. What do you think the biggest potential pitfalls are?
No, it's a good question. I mean, in some ways, the increasing publications, I think, you know, it reflects an interest in the area, which generally I think is a good thing, but there are concerns. So I think a lot of papers, it's just a reanalysis of existing registry data. And I think Prem touched on this, and I loved his example of the idea that you're really just holding up a mirror to our data. And it's important because I think you're not really finding anything new. You're just analyzing it a different way. But I think when you consider like the philosophy about what we spoke about earlier about machine learning, machine learning being about emulating human behavior, sometimes to me, it's not clear that why we need some of the studies that have been published. For example, you know, machine learning outperforms logistic regression. I mean, to me, it makes sense that if you tried several different algorithmic approaches to predicting something, it's likely to do better than just one. The bigger question is like, does it really advance our understanding of the clinical problem or move us towards a solution? I think context is important also. It's not unusual to see a paper that promotes a machine learning algorithm for predicting, say like patient-reported outcomes or satisfactions, but then they often refer the reader to a Shiny app or some type of web link that you can go to and use the model. And I get it. I mean, that's cool. I think that's great. But oftentimes, these Shiny apps only kind of take in a small handful of variables. For example, maybe like age, current smoker, BMI, whether someone's diabetic. And they use that to kind of produce a prediction. I think this kind of presents a few problems. One, just on face, it's hard to believe that a patient's outcome would be determined by like their age, their smoking status, the BMI, and whether or not they have diabetes. What this actually probably reflects is these are the variables that maximize a set of metrics the authors were using when kind of constructing these machine learning models. And in some ways, you can think it's almost like a poor representation of machine learning because I'm not, you know, sure it's really reflecting what, you know, what it's intended to do. I think the other issue, though, is external validation. And this was touched on a bit in the previous podcast, but I think it's really critical for these type of models. So patient expectations, surgeon preferences, comorbidities, they're all vary from practice to practice. So when a machine learning algorithm is developed exclusively on a single practice's patients, it's unlikely, or I would even say at best unknown, whether it will hold when used outside the practice. And to give authors credit, you know, a lot of them note these limitations, but I think the message gets mixed when the readers refer to the Shiny app. And then while these Shiny app web pages do provide some external validity disclaimer, it's like it's hard to unsee what you've already seen. And it's tempting to just start, you know, plugging in some numbers and getting predictions. And, you know, that's not to say that they're all bad. I mean, many provide Shapley values, which provide local explanation for prediction, like I was talking about previously, and we can talk about a little bit more in a minute. But nevertheless, I think the message gets mixed and the intentions are kind of unclear. The other concern I would have about sort of the increasing amount of publications has to do with just data science practices themselves. I mean, there's an entire field focused on data science. They have well-established practices and guidelines. There are ethics that sort of guide them. There's well-educated professionals who have been educated and do this type of work for a living. They focus on things like fair and equitable models, transparent methods, et cetera. These are sort of all core components of what they do. And so while there may be some good machine learning papers in our literature, many of them fail to adhere to these basic practices. A good example is like the provision of a repository for the code and software used. Again, this was touched on previously, but I think it's important. This is like a basic practice among data scientists, yet it's one that almost is universally ignored in our literature. And when you think about it, it's really not all that surprising that many authors aren't doing this because many authors aren't data scientists, but rather they're just very well-meaning researchers that are really kind of using parts of a practice of another discipline, that being like data science, but not all of those things when they're generating this AI-related research, you know, in subsequent manuscript. So if we're going to develop research that uses machine learning models to support some type of AI, it would probably serve us well to understand the data science practices and do things that they do, like making the code available, like addressing and mitigating bias. Otherwise, I guess my concern would be that we're going to continue to populate the literature with machine learning papers about, you know, really for the sake of publishing papers about machine learning. Like, I don't see it really moving forward. I just think it's sort of more of a demonstration of what it can do and not sort of, you know, a clear mission of how we're moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point you bring up at the tail end of your response there, where you talked about the intersection of basically two fairly different fields of science, you know, orthopedic surgery and computer science. And while there's probably some overlap, you know, at least from an intellectual interest perspective, you know, when you kind of picture an orthopedic surgeon in training, you know, focusing on, you know, the biological sciences and medicine and anatomy, and then you're picturing the computer scientist who's, you know, a very hard scientist working on code and such. I mean, we're now discussing kind of an intersection in research of those two types of folks. And like you said, their approach to publishing is just conceptually different in terms of, you know, what the requirements are for a publication. And I know at the editors meeting, we kind of talked about that and touched on that from, you know, an editorial board perspective. What's the responsibility to kind of have this minimum standard for publishing on a computer science related topic in a orthopedic journal? So I know we're going to talk about that a little more later, but let's just kind of hammer it home now. From your perspective as a researcher and an editor, what do you think are the minimum necessary standards for a paper on AI or machine learning, you know, to achieve the you know, intended goals in an orthopedic journal?
So I think there's a few. I think for one, I think it's important to specify whether a problem has been addressed and in why a machine learning or AI-driven approach is needed and what's its intention, like what should it be trying to accomplish? So as we discussed, some of these papers are just reanalyses of existing registry of practice data, and they seem to serve, and I get it, to demonstrate that a machine learning approach is powerful, like it can outperform some of the traditional approaches. So I think to answer your question, I think as a start, it really should be like, first, what is the problem and why do we need this type of approach? In addition, you know, I think, you know, we need to consider that oftentimes that these papers, I mean, they're trying to emulate human decision, right? That's sort of the, I don't want to say the guiding principle, but the motivation or the objective of sort of why you would venture down a machine learning road. And so the question is, like, when we see these papers and some of them, you know, are very good, like, then what's next? If indeed there's potential to improve upon the current state of a problem with some type of AI-driven research, right, you'd expect a line of research looking at the process from end to end, you know, specifically defining a problem, developing a model, deploying the model externally, evaluating its performance, and then sort of moving towards some type of implementation. I think what often happens, though, is that we get papers that seem to be like one-offs. They show the potential for machine learning to provide, you know, greater predictive power than what we've seen before with traditional methods. And then investigators seem to kind of move on to the next clinical problem, you know, whether it's, you know, posterior meniscal root tears or Bankart lesions, you know, they, you know, sometimes I feel like that data is grabbed. And then we then again redemonstrate the predictive power of like a suite of algorithms that come from the machine learning community to show that, in fact, that, you know, a machine learning approach can definitely boost your predictive power. So I'd say at a minimum, we should try to discern what the goal of the research is and whether the machine learning approach is needed. And rather than whether it's just a simple demonstration of what machine learning can do. You know, I think another important concept is to address external validation, which simply refers to the performance of the model in different settings. So I don't necessarily think that a submission needs to have developed a model, internally validated it, meaning they've trained it on their data and then tested it on other data that they have that wasn't included in the model, and then went out and externally validated before they can make a submission. But I think that discussion needs to be upfront. And I think that idea of external validation needs to be upfront, especially in these papers looking at patient expectations, patient satisfaction, and patient reported outcomes, because these things are so apt to vary from setting to setting. And then finally, I think, you know, it's a tough topic, but I think you should consider incentives. I mean, for better or worse, published papers are currency, right? They get students keep trying to get into medical school. They're important for medical students trying to get into residency. They're important for the resident trying to get a fellowship. They're important for a faculty member who's looking to advance. I get it. We've all benefited from it, including myself. But I also think it's important to sort of look at that angle a little bit, because is sort of complicated as the statistics and the underlying things that are happening under the hood may be, they're not the hardest things to sort of fit, right? With a little bit of coding and a little bit of knowledge of certain open source software, which again is free, it's kind of easy to read in a CSV. It's easy to run a suite of algorithms and get some results. It's easy to generate metrics like area under the curve and you know, these different things that we put in machine learning papers. And then it's easy to incorporate that into a paper. And by no means am I saying that people are running around recklessly fitting these models, but I think we've, you know, this is a problem that's been going on for decades, that, you know, publication is currency, and sometimes there may just be incentive, you know, to publish these things. And I think if we keep an awareness of that, at least from the perspective of, you know, sort of the manuscripts we consider or the papers we read, and just sort of try to determine, you know, where is it that we're trying to advance, maybe, you know, the understanding of a clinical problem, or sort of automate something that we couldn't automate before, or develop some type of decision-making algorithm that could assist with clinical care. And then where are the papers that, again, well-intended, that may just be demonstrating, here's what machine learning can do, because there's plenty of those out there. And I, you know, I think that's an area where I don't think we need many more.
Yeah, I think the breadth of publication has certainly expanded. I think now we're alluding to the need to kind of maybe improve the depth and kind of the significance of the studies that are being done. You've mentioned, and we've touched on a few times already, the validation of these models. When I was reading one of your editorial commentaries, I learned of this new term called distributional shift, where you describe that as a shift from one set of circumstances to another, i.e. when a machine learning algorithm is trained on one set of data, like you've said, it becomes internally validated when, you know, it's applied to a set of data and then tested, and then, you know, tested against more data from that same institution. But then when an attempt is made to apply that algorithm to another scenario or outside data, that's when you can run into that difficulty with external validation. So I know you said that you don't consider that necessarily a requirement for publishing papers, but just how much do you think it matters, the battle between internal and external validation for these newly developed machine learning models?
Yeah, well, I think it matters quite a bit. I mean, there's certainly situations, and you touched on them in the previous podcast, where maybe it doesn't matter as much, but I think a lot of what's germane to orthopedic research is, how does the patient do, which patient reported outcomes, right? Or just simply satisfaction, or it could be just be a binary answer, like I'm better, I'm happy, whatever it may be. And those things, and I think you know from experience, are dependent on so many different variables. And so the idea with distributional shift, it's a nice term, but really what it's saying is a mismatch, right? It's a mismatch between the data I trained on and then and tested on and made my model on. And then when it's deployed outside of my arena, how well it performs. And so in that context, especially when we're talking about something that's kind of patient driven, you can see how a model could perform very well within a certain practice setting, but kind of fail to perform well when it leaves that setting. So I think it's, you know, it's super important. You know, one of the sort of famous examples of it is it's just not patient expectations. It can be other things, right? And a famous, well, I say famous, but a recent example that got some press was some a group of researchers at Mount Sinai that were looking at, I think they were trying to predict maybe pneumonia from a battery of stuff they were feeding the model from images, stuff in the medical record, and it performed extraordinarily well. To their credit, they've got a set of data from two different institutions, and it didn't perform as well. And what was interesting was that the model was keying in on the fact that the folks that had, you know, pneumonia or some type of pulmonary problem tended to be in bed because of, you know, the nature of the hospital they were at, and they had to use a portable X-ray machine. So at the end of the day, that great model was sort of dependent somewhat on the fact that a portable X-ray machine was being used. So that's another example of sort of the mismatch or that distributional shift. It doesn't always have to be patient expectations. It can be something like a portable X-ray machine, but it does sort of underscore the point, especially contextual to orthopedics, where we're not, most of the time, what we're thinking about is how patients do, that how patients do kind of depends on a lot of different stuff. And machine learning and AI is great, and I think it's going to advance our understanding of a lot of these things. But I think if we just plow forward full speed and don't think about these things, we're going to put ourselves at risk for kind of getting some of this stuff wrong.
So just to really dig into the weeds of stats here, because this is your area of expertise. You mentioned it earlier on in our conversation, the concept of Shapley values. I doubt anybody who hasn't read about this topic knows what that is. Can you just explain for us what the concept of a Shapley value is and how they're used and applied?
Sure. So Shapley values come from cooperative game theory. So the idea is that you're trying to figure out the relative contribution of, say, in this case, each of your variables. So if we go back to what I was talking about earlier with that Dr. Doshi Falez and that idea of local explanation, the reason we may have these AI technologies is that it's hard. If we were able to hold that all that information in our brains and make these decisions, we wouldn't need this sort of technology or this sort of approach to sort of help us with, you know, making predictions or kind of understanding what's happening. One of the things you can do is local explanation. So if you have a patient and there's a given prediction for that patient, what a Shapley value is doing is it's showing you what variables. So let's back up a second. Say it says that it says there's some risk for infection, or there's some particular treatment you should do. What's important there is to understand, we can't understand the whole model. I mean, we kind of can, but generally speaking, right, it's going to be really hard to understand all the statistical mechanics that are happening under the hood. But what we can do is say, for this given patient, you predicted X, and why was it that X came out of this model? And so what a Shapley value will give you is sort of a list of the data that was incorporated into your model. And then for that particular patient, how much their weighting or how much contribution was from each of those variables went into this decision. So you may look at one decision or this particular prediction and see that a large portion of this prediction was based off the patient's age. And then maybe a little bit was based off their BMI, and maybe a little bit was based off, say, their sex, maybe a little bit was based off their preoperative score. But the biggest thing the model was considering when it made this particular prediction was age. And this is sort of where I think the two things merge. As a clinician, you can maybe recognize that, yes, I get that maybe age is something that is predictive of having a bad outcome. But I'm the clinician, and I understand that even though this person has maybe an age that's like indicative of being very old, they're not an old patient. And so in that regard, when you're seeing that local explanation, which is what the Shapley value provides you, it can kind of help guide you as to say that I understand why this the model is making this recommendation. The model is a model, and it's less than perfect. But I can now evaluate the fact that because it puts so much emphasis on age, that's not something I'm putting emphasis on, because I have the clinical expertise and the experience to understand that in this particular case, I don't think the just the, you know, the raw age of this person is really reflective of what the metric age is typically intended to reflect in a model, which is right, just some type of degradation over time as we get older. So that's really what that Shapley value is giving you. And again, they can be very valuable because you can see, maybe you can't understand exactly all the intricacies of a model, but you can at least understand what exactly is it valuing when it's making a prediction. And I think that's where that intersection between using AI as a tool to assist in clinical decision-making, not replace it, kind of really matters, because it sort of nicely merges with, you know, the clinician's own experience plus what the model's saying.
Sure. I always enjoy when the editorial commentaries have catchy titles, as yours did when you mentioned the venture into the valley of despair, where you were referencing the classic dip in the Dunning-Kruger effect graphical depiction, where increased competence correlates to this rapid drop in confidence when somebody realizes just how much they actually don't know about a topic. Can you just tell us about the Dunning-Kruger effect and why you feel like, in terms of AI, we as a collective profession are just about to summit Mount Stupid and inevitably descend into this valley of despair?
Yeah, thanks. I have to credit Ian Wellington on that one. He co-authored in discussing these issues. He was able to quickly relate it to the infamous Dunning-Kruger effect. So the Dunning-Kruger curve basically plots confidence against knowledge. So the idea is that, like, when you're learning about a new field or subject, a little bit of knowledge can give you a lot of confidence. But that also can, like, kind of be a problem, right? When you lack knowledge, your confidence is high. So this is kind of what's considered Mount Stupid. The example that has always come to mind for me, for whatever reason, is poker. I mean, I'm not a gambler, but I think poker is fascinating. And I think it fits the Dunning-Kruger effect kind of nicely. So I can imagine, like, when you start playing poker, maybe you start learning a little bit to improve your game. And so you learn a little bit about odds and probability. And then you successfully kind of use this information to your advantage when you're casually playing with, you know, your friends in some type of, you know, friendly poker game. So your confidence is high, yet there's really a lot more to know. And then soon this little bit of knowledge may become a problem, especially when the poker game involves, like, more experienced players, let's say. And then suddenly your losses start stacking up. And so the idea is, now that you're in the valley of despair, you've realized that you actually have limited knowledge. You know, you kind of moved into this arena. You learned some things that gave you a lot of confidence, but now you realize there's so much more to know. Not only that, you're not really succeeding, so you have really no context. You know, and in that context, I guess in this example, you probably also don't have a lot of money left. But moving on, if you devote the time to study the mechanics of poker and all the things associated with it, like game theory, and start to understand patterns of betting and a variety of other information, because there's a lot out there that you need to consider, you kind of slowly but progressively gain knowledge. And as you gain that knowledge, you gain confidence. And this sort of kind of continues until you hit what they call the peak of enlightenment, where now not only do you have a high amount of knowledge, you also have a high amount of confidence. And so I thought this was sort of like an apt description of where we may collectively be when it comes to AI in the realm of orthopedic research. That editorial itself was a commentary on actually Prem's paper on meaningless applications and misguided uses of AI in orthopedic related research. And to me, it was clear that there's some good papers out there, but there's also a lot of bad ones. So it seems like confidence is high, especially with the shiny apps, the catchy manuscript titles, and oftentimes the very definitive conclusions. So I don't know if we're at the peak of Mount Stupid, but per the available literature, it doesn't seem like we fully understand machine learning and AI related research, nor would I say that we really have a clear goal or mission for integrating AI into practice. Rather, when back then, when I looked at it, I think what we've figured out is how to publish papers on these approaches. And I'm not really sure how that moves us forward.
So what do you think is the end game for AI? What do you see as the ideal future course for its use in the greater field of orthopedics?
Well, end game sounds very ominous.
What do you think? So, what do you think what do you think is our beacon that we should be heading toward?
No, it's a very good question. So I've spent a lot of time pointing out, you know, many concerns, but I am optimistic. I want to circle back a little bit to that Dr. Doshi Velez's talk that I mentioned earlier. And I think she actually makes a really great point about AI systems towards the end of her talk. And it went something along the lines of, to not use our tools to synthesize and manage all of the medical information really is to accept all the current harms due to our human inabilities. And what I like about that statement is it sort of speaks to the potential value of AI in orthopedics. What I like about her talk in general is it struck a balance between using AI, but also, you know, holding them accountable. So I would say, like, as far as an ideal course, you know, I agree with a lot of what Prem said in the last podcast, that there are some really useful applications for AI right now. And many of them would be to, like, unburden the administrative side of providing care. I also think, you know, AI applications to, like, improve the patient experience as opposed to directing their care would also be valuable. We don't spend a lot of time in that, but I think, you know, that field is well suited to address that. I think it's also worth trying to understand aspects of machine learning and AI that we maybe not have previously considered, like I was trying to explain before in that example where we were looking at machine learning models for overnight stay, but really what we were trying to do is see, like, would a globally performing model that does very well, or performs very well, excuse me, would perform equitably across race and ethnicity? And I think those are, like, important points before, like, plowing forward. And I also think we should, you know, we would benefit greatly from working with data scientists and other experts in this realm to sort of assist in developing some of these models and some of these technologies. I mean, there's a whole field out there that exists. And I think to try to do it in isolation is a mistake. I'm actually, as much as I sound like I'm sort of putting down all that's come out, I'm actually sort of excited about it and see the potential. But I think to realize the potential and to move that potential forward, you know, we're going to have to sort of engage, you know, with people that have been, you know, educated and trained to do this for a living.
Yeah, I think all great points. And as always, Mark, you've got a knack for explaining these fairly challenging topics in a nice, relatable way. I want to thank you for sharing your time and your thoughts with us today. Did you have any other closing remarks before we wrap up?
I didn't think I did, but I wanted more guidance. So I trained a model to figure out whether I had more closing remarks. But I knew enough to know that this model I had was just a tool to assist me. And this model is saying it kind of agrees with my own perspective right now, which is, I think we've covered as much as you know, we can cover in the podcast. So I have no other closing remarks, but thank you for having me. I'm always happy to talk about this stuff. By no means am I an expert. These are just perspectives from someone, you know, looking at the research. But I think it's a great topic. I think it's important that we continue to talk about it, because if we don't continue to talk about it, I think we're all going to get confused and, you know, machine learning and AI-driven technologies are coming. And I think that's great, but I think we have the responsibility to sort of think about how we're going to implement these things and sort of the benefits and the risks associated with them.
Well, maybe one day your algorithm will just talk to my algorithm and we can both sit back and listen to a conversation that happens without either of us even here.
I agree.
Well, thanks again, Mark. Mark Cody's editorial commentary titled Machine Learning in Orthopedics, Venturing into the Valley of Despair is available in the September 2022 issue of the Arthroscopy Journal, which is available online at www.arthroscopyjournal.org. This concludes this edition of the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next time.